Hey there, welcome to ATL on 29, the podcast that looks at the NBA from the starting point of Atlanta. My name is Kevin Chouinard, and today I'm with guest Sean O'Connor, who is a blogger who writes about the Philadelphia 76ers. And if you look at the history of the Hawks and 76ers over the past 12 months, there's a lot of overlap, a lot of exchanging, a lot of interchangeable parts, and so I thought it would be interesting to have Sean on to talk about it. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
That was a terrible intro, but this is what happens when you take 2 weeks off. And
you know,
before that, I think I took
like
4 weeks off. So I think I have like one podcast in the last 6 weeks, but it's that time of year.
Yeah, we're getting back started. I'm excited.
Well, of course, because the 76ers are going to be a good team in a dismal conference, and they're going to do well. It's easy to be excited.
Yeah, well, it's easy to be excited, especially since we haven't had too many of these seasons recently up until last year.
That's true. And so, you know, in just looking at the list of names of people that have gone from the 76ers to the Hawks or vice versa, you know, we've got Lloyd Pierce, the head coach of the Hawks, came over after being a 76ers assistant. The Hawks now have Justin Anderson, Alex Poitras, Thomas Robinson. You know, the Sixers have had Marco Bellinelli, Ersan Ilyasova, and now they've got Mike Muscala. A lot of cross-threading there, for lack of a better term. But let's start with Justin Anderson. You know, for Hawks fans who might not be terribly familiar with his game, what do you think that they'll get out of Anderson this season?
So I really like Justin Anderson. I'm really sad, honestly, that he's gone from the Sixers. He's a really tough wing defender. He gets in people's faces. He flashed an improved jumper last year before he was injured about midway through the season and kind of fell out of the rotation once Marco Bellinelli and Ersan Ilyasova came over. But he's average to slightly above average size wing, very strong, and flashes a shot. He's not a dumb player either. He makes the right play most of the time, especially on defense. And especially since the Hawks have kind of, I don't want to say made wings out of nothing, but have really developed wing players well over the last 5 to 10 years even. I'm excited to see what he can do because he's got a lot of tools to work with. And he was adding skills to those tools last year that made me really optimistic about his future. It was just a few poorly timed injuries that really sapped his playing time. And then eventually replacements came in, especially with Bellinelli midway through the year from the Hawks, that kind of took him out of the rotation. So I'm looking forward to seeing him getting playing time and seeing if his shooting holds up and if he can make an impact there.
I think if you discuss this from a Hawks fan's point of view, one natural question would be, you know, why did Bellinelli play over him in the playoffs? I mean, if I don't know, I'm a little bit skeptical, just, you know, if he's as good as you say he is, shouldn't he have been better than Bellinelli?
Yeah, and trust me, on the Sixers end, we were clamoring for more Anderson minutes in the playoffs. Over Bellinelli. And I understand where Brett Brown was coming from. Bellinelli was pretty much the source of most of the offense from the second squad. They really relied on either him or JJ Redick when Redick was playing, running off screens to create offense because they ran so few pick and rolls as a team. The Sixers, I think, were last in the NBA last year in pick and rolls run as a team, despite having the most passes and a high number of possessions. And it's just because they preferred to generate offense through off-ball movement and through post-game with Embiid. And so having shooting and off-ball movement in Bellinelli was really important to them, even if Bellinelli wasn't hitting shots or was playing erratically like he tends to do. So even if he wasn't playing well, they still thought that Bellinelli would be a valuable contributor just because of the attention he draws. When Anderson played in the playoffs, he actually played really well. He did get a couple of techs against Dwayne Wade in the first round, but he really held his own defensively and added something that I think that they really sorely missed in the second round against the Celtics. So I guess the answer there is your answer is as good as mine. I don't really know why he didn't play more. But Brett trusted Bellinelli, and that's kind of what it came down to.
Okay. Maybe before we leave the topic entirely, are the Sixers going to miss Bellinelli and Ilyasova this season?
Well, Marco Bellinelli was having a bit of a fever dream the last 30 games of the year. So will they miss all-star offensive player Marco Bellinelli from the regular season? Yes. Was that sustainable? Probably not. On the other hand, Ilyasova, I think they will miss a bit. He was here. It was a second stint in Philadelphia. He was traded to the Hawks before eventually, I believe, re-signing there. And he really worked well with Embiid. And the Sixers bench really doesn't have anyone except for, to a degree, Muscala to replace him, although I'm skeptical of that fit. So I do think that they'll miss Ilyasova. I just don't know if Bellinelli would have been what he did last year, if that was sustainable over a longer course of time. I just don't think it was. So I'm okay with him leaving, replacing him with a stronger wing defender in Wilson Chandler.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued by the Muscala thing. I sort of think that he can be a reasonable facsimile for Ilyasova. I mean, I think he brings more to the table in certain areas. I think he might be – I think I know that he's a better shooter than Ilyasova is. Like, Ilyasova takes a lot of attempts, but if you look at the last few years, he's never been that accurate. I mean, that's just kind of the thing he does. And he can use it to – you know, he can use – just the volume of shots that he takes to kind of throw in a pump fake and do some dribble counters off of that. But I think Muscala is a better shooter. I think he's a better passer. I think he moves a little bit better out on the perimeter in terms of like contesting shots. He's just not going to be as stout inside. I don't think he gives you the same level of defensive protection in the paint that Ilyasova does, whether it's just kind of getting his body in the way for a charge or just being physical and keeping bodies away from the basket. I don't know. I actually just think that he might be a better fit in Philadelphia than he was in Atlanta. Muscala, that is, just because we didn't really have the athletic talent to put around Muscala to kind of help him out. But I think, you know, if he gets some spot duty with the starters and things like that, I think he'll be a really good fit. I think he just, you know, if taking into account how much Ilyasova and Bellinelli helped because they were offensively competent, I think kind of Muscala fits in that vein as well. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree from that perspective, actually. And it's not really an issue with Muscala. The one thing you can count on Ersan to do was get his. He would shoot. And his attempts are much higher, which to me is a good thing for what the Sixers need. They need someone who's willing and able to shoot, even if they're not completely open.
Right.
And I never got that impression. Maybe I'm wrong. From
no,
Muscala,
I think you're right.
where he was more willing to shoot when open. But if it was a bit contested, he might look to keep moving the ball. And he is a good passer, and he makes smart plays based off of everything that I've read and seen over the years. I do watch a fair amount of league pass. Certainly not as much as someone that watches the Hawks for a living. But my impression was that he would need to kind of be more assertive offensively.
Yep.
And in the limited minutes he gets, I do wonder how that he's expected to get. I do wonder how assertive he will be, because I think that'll be the most important thing for him here.
All right. Well, if you know, I think an even more important topic from the Hawks' point of view is what to expect out of Lloyd Pierce. It's hard, I know, to try to put anything together in terms of trying to separate what an assistant coach does from what the rest of the staff does. That's an impossible thing to do. There's no real way to separate it, but you know, at least Pierce did have the reputation of being the person who was in charge of the defense. If you look at what the 76ers do schematically, compared to what a generic NBA team has done schematically over the last couple of years, what stands out about the Sixers in terms of their approach?
So it's interesting. So I do think that Lloyd Pierce did a great job with the Sixers defense, and everything that you've read about him being the defensive coordinator or whatnot is true. That's something where Brett Brown, I think he really took it from when Greg Popovich was his head coach while he was an assistant in San Antonio, where he really likes to delegate. So Lloyd Pierce really does have chops coaching defense at the highest level. That said, his defenses are, I won't say traditional, but they're very in line with what you'd expect given the Sixers roster. So they liked playing big. As you know, Ben Simmons being a 6'10 point guard makes it easy to put size on the court defensively. And so what their aim, at least at the beginning of the season, was to use that size to kind of bother as many people as they could. And then from there, funnel all of the action into Embiid. Keep it out of the middle of the paint, maybe drive baseline, not maybe drive baseline, but really drive the action toward the baseline and have Embiid be a helper. Because there's no greater helper aside from maybe Rudy Gobert in the NBA than Joel Embiid. So what you'd expect given having Embiid in the middle is what they did at the beginning of the season. As time went along, they actually started changing their defensive philosophy during the season. So they played mostly man up to start. Their players would prioritize fighting through screens. And what that resulted in mostly was situations where Embiid was cleaning up after others, and the defense was doing fine. Later on the season, they did eventually switch to having a more of a switching scheme, especially 1 through 4, with Embiid still the backbone of the defense at the 5. What that created was essentially, it created a lot of switches, which teams would target J.J. Redick or Marco Bellinelli and then hope to beat them one-on-one, with the idea being make the other team play one-on-one, they're likely not to be that efficient. And it worked out really well until the Boston Celtics happened and they had a center who could shoot threes. and
yeah.
So this schematically it worked. The Sixers, I think, were the third best defense in the NBA last year.
So if a team – oh, sorry to interrupt. Before we get away from it, you mentioned, you know, if they have a center that shoots threes. You mentioned that later in the season that they were, you know, switching more of the pick and rolls. When it was, you know, 1 through 4, what were they doing when Embiid was in it?
So when Embiid was in, they switched up to Saric. But then if it was a center pick and roll, they would usually have – the guards, whoever was defending on the perimeter, try to fight through the screen and have Embiid sit back. And then
so like a drop, more of a drop coverage.
Yeah, more of a drop. Embiid, they didn't like him switching on the perimeter because he's got a little bit of happy feet. Even though he can contest shots with his length, pretty much anywhere on the court, it wasn't necessarily an ideal situation to have him away from the rim. And it usually worked because most teams don't have centers that could shoot threes as well as Al Horford did. And that scheme was kind of exposed when the Sixers played the Celtics in the playoffs. And given that, their adjustments then were as good as they could make them. They put Embiid on Marcus Smart for large stretches of time in that series. They did everything they could to mask that, to mask that weakness. But they were unable to eventually come up with a scheme to beat the Celtics with Embiid on the court. And I do wonder for the Sixers how that what that means going forward. And for Pierce, he made adjustments and a lot of them worked. But I do wonder if situations like that come up again, is he or a coach that, or if he does offensive defensive coordinator as well, are they willing to take that center out for possessions that matter on defense and willing to go small even though your center's your best defender?
Interesting. It's funny that this is the discussion that we're having, because we planned the second part of our episode to be that we're going to rank the second best players on each team in the Eastern Conference. And I have a feeling that we're going to come back to, at least on my part, I'm coming back to this discussion of Horford and Embiid a little bit.
I'm coming back to it too, don't worry.
All right. I know that you've. Oh, let's see here. Staying with this idea of Embiid and talking about the 76ers' style of defense, was there a difference in the style that they played when they had Embiid on the floor versus when they didn't? I mean, maybe this might be a really simple answer. It was, you know, maybe they would switch everything if Embiid wasn't out there, and like we already said, you know, they'd drop him if they had him out there. But was there anything else that was noticeably different?
Yeah, I mean, when they replaced him with Amir Johnson, who's another more traditional center despite his lack of size, mm-hmm. they played basically the same way.
Okay.
When they had Ilyasova play center, they did switch everything. And those defenses ultimately did not fare well, mostly because they didn't quite have the size, because usually they were playing Redick or Bellinelli, to really defend 5-on-5, man up, switch everything. They would always get exposed. And furthermore, because of not having that center out there, the rim was basically open season for the opponents. So they did switch, but the personnel just wasn't there to kind of stand up to that type of defense.
It's like the opposite of the Hawks in the playoffs 2 seasons ago when they played the Wizards. And this would be the iteration of the Hawks that had Dwight Howard and Ersan Ilyasova.
Oh, that one. Yep.
They were playing the drop coverage with Dwight, and it was getting massacred by Bradley Beal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a much better team when they put Ilyasova at center and switched everything. Even Jose Calderon, they had him out there in a lot of those lineups, yep. And they just switched everything. And that was the best thing that they did defensively in the playoffs. So it's interesting contrast.
But in a sense, if you think about it, it's actually not too different than what the Sixers were dealing with, because nominally Dwight was the best defensive player on that Hawks team.
No, Paul Millsap was.
Oh, well, yeah. Paul Millsap.
Good point. And it's good funny. Point. And he was in both of the lineups. And, you know, he was good enough to the point that, you know, even though he was probably 6'5" and a half or something, he was a moderately good rim protector when he was out there. I mean, you could nominally call him the center as well, mm-hmm. but it provided an interesting contrast. So, yeah, it was basically the Howard-Millsap front court, or the Millsap-Ilyasova front court, and it was the latter that was much better.
But it's the same thing where having a center who's not comfortable or you don't like defending in space,
yep.
against a team that can appropriately attack that. The question is, do you stick with it? And how long do you stick with it? And is there any benefit to having them on the offensive end of the court?
Yep.
Which Dwight Howard answers, obviously no.
Nope.
with Embiid, you would argue in last year's playoffs, the answer was also no, but the Sixers stuck with him because he is their best player. Again, we're going to get back to this discussion later, but
wow.
But you could have argued that they should have yanked him basically because of how well Al Horford defended him.
Right.
So, but that's another topic for another day.
All right. Well, one of the first things that happened after the Hawks hired Lloyd Pierce is we came into the gym maybe a day or two after the press conference, and they had the four-point line, quote-unquote four-point line, painted on the floor, and that's definitely an idea that Pierce brought with him from Philadelphia, because I believe it was the 76ers that first tried that, just as a teaching technique or as a mental reminder to the players who were out there in practices on where they should be on the floor. Do you think that had any real effect in what the Sixers did?
Yeah, I think it did. The Sixers had a number of players who were more comfortable than most shooting further from beyond the three-point line. Robert Covington stands most among them. He would regularly launch from what the four-point line is in a regular game. Bellinelli was the same way, mm-hmm. where he was And now, granted, that's probably not the 4-point line talking. That's probably the irrational confidence talking. But they have several players who are. But they had guys who are willing to take shots from far beyond the 3-point line. And it does create additional space, especially for Embiid in the post. So I think it was important for them to kind of emphasize, hey, stand further out, even if it's not actually worth 4 points. It does create additional space. I know Houston last year kind of revolutionized players being set well behind the 3-point line, but the Sixers were not that far behind them with that, especially Covington, because his range from 24 versus 28 is essentially the same. So, yeah, I think they did it, and I think it helped. It bends the defense more than standing right at the 3-point line, which with Embiid on the court is just so important for us. For a team like the Hawks that don't stand to play that way, I do wonder what the additional benefit is. But if it encourages players to improve their range, I don't see that as being a negative.
Okay. I know you didn't get to see as much of them, not nearly as much of them as you've seen of Justin Anderson or Lloyd Pierce, but the Hawks have a couple of players. Alex Poitras on a two-way contract, Thomas Robinson, who's probably on what you might call a training camp contract. Let's start with Poitras, who was with the Sixers for a handful of games at the end of the 16-17 season. What did you see out of him when he was with the Sixers?
I actually liked Poitras when he was here, if he could move down a position. So when he played with the Sixers, he mostly played at the nominal power forward, although he really was more of a wing on offense. He seemed like he had good shooting form. He seemed reasonably athletic. The issue just seemed to be that he really wasn't mobile enough to defend threes at the time. I do know he's had a couple cups of coffee with NBA teams since then, and I think he has played more of a wing since. But I remember me thinking, oh, if he was either just a bit faster or 2 inches taller, he'd be an NBA player. Because he got an extended show here and was able to do some good things, had a couple of good nights. So on a two-way deal, I think that's a reasonably good chance to take to see if he can become something. Thomas Robinson, I have a sweet spot in my heart for. He played here for, I think, the second half of one season during the process.
The deep process.
I was very deep in the process. And he actually played really well for us. He basically can only play the five, even though he's probably 6'8 or 6'9 in actual height.
Okay.
But nowadays is normal.
Yep.
But he plays the five, but isn't much of a rim protector. So he's a good finisher, great rebounder, played with energy here, and gave effort on both ends. He was actually a lot of fun to have around, really entertaining for what he brought to the table. But on defense, he just leaves something to be desired. I don't know if it's instinctual. I don't know if it's whatever toxins flow around in Sacramento when you first go there to start your career. but his defense just really never clicked. And then after, he played well enough in Philadelphia to get a contract with the Lakers afterward. And so my hope for him is that he does make more of an impact defensively. And if he does, I think he's a real NBA backup center. But if he doesn't, he's probably just not good enough offensively to be worth it.
Seems fair. When you look at a player like that who was with the 76ers in that extended stretch of processing, real hard processing. How do you evaluate a player in that context? Like, is it hard to separate what's happening with one player from the collective?
So in my mind, no. Because everyone's really auditioning on teams like that because they know that they're either a centerpiece or they're not, and they're playing for their next team or if they're building something into the team they're currently on. So you can easily see what players' skills are so long as you have an environment which kind of lets the players do that. And the Sixers during those times were, I don't know how to properly say it. They were not a very structured team. They kind of just ran with it. And you can kind of see what players' talents were. You can see how fast Thomas Robinson ran up and down the court. You can see how poor he reacted to normal defensive concepts. you can see those things, and especially since you're in that case, you're not really rooting for wins or losses. So you end up watching the game, just hoping to find someone or root for players to progress so they become a part of your future. So I didn't actually think it was hard to evaluate players.
Okay.
I think it got a bad rap because a lot of times it didn't have a real point guard. And I think that was fair. But because players were given playing time they otherwise wouldn't have received in many other situations, and because they had the freedom to make mistakes, I think it was actually a good learning environment and a good scouting environment too. I think we were able to really tell who could be an NBA player based off of what we saw during their limited time here. A good example of that's actually Dwayne Dedmon, current Hawk, who had a couple 10 days here. And you could tell right away he was going to be a good defender, or at least an NBA level defender, because he was so big and mobile.
Right.
Did I ever envision him taking however many threes he took last year? Not a chance. But I could see that he was big, tall, mobile, and if he could, you know, improve his hands, improve his handle, improve his awareness, that guy's got an NBA future. And it turns out he did. And you could see other players who come in and just look like they're not big enough for the NBA, they're not good enough at shooting, not athletic enough. And you could see that in like a relatively small sample. It's not it actually wasn't as hard as you think.
I want to backtrack a little bit. When you were talking about the Sixers defense,
yep,
you said that they played with a lot of size, that, you know, if they were using Ben Simmons as the nominal point guard on offense, they could roll up some really big lineups defensively.
Yep.
In those situations, how did they go about collectively dealing with who was going to guard the point guard?
That's a good question. It basically switched by the matchup. So the primary point guard defender normally would be J.J. Redick, just because he's the smallest guy on the court. He's about 6'3", 6'4", not much length. So he would usually guard the smallest person on the court. But if it was a point guard, that would give him problems, he being a 33-year-old who at best has average lateral quickness, they would then choose which of Covington or Simmons would be the primary defender. I think 70-30, it was Covington who got the assignment.
Okay.
And Covington, being first-team all-defense last year, could take pretty much whoever and do a good job on them. And so that allowed for Redick to take a weaker assignment and for Simmons to play more of a roaming role, which really suited his strengths well. He could play passing lanes, he can get out on the break, create cross switches, which really helped the Sixers in transition. So the answer is it depended on the matchup. If it was a tough offensive player, Covington more often than not got the role, but it was never clear cut. They would switch fairly often, even throughout games, what the assignments were.
Yeah, I like those looks with Covington guarding the point guard. And it's funny that you, Matt, mentioned the how the mismatches ended up affecting what would happen in transition going the other way, because that's kind of the next question I wanted to ask you, and I don't know quite how to frame it, but let me try. I mean, I expect the Hawks to use a big dose of Trae Young this season.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I saw of him in summer league, you know, I liked what I saw defensively in a lot of ways. You know, starting with, I think he has good fundamentals, good instincts. You know, he tries hard to fight through screens. He's got really good hands from a defensive point of view, not just offensively.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought he did well playing in a team context defensively when he was out there guarding point guards. But there were some situations, especially the ones where there were mismatches in transition, where, you know, maybe it was one-on-one, him going back against, you know, a power forward center type. And it was just, it was not good. I mean, he didn't look like a defensive player. He looked like a shirt. And he's just not big. And right. Have the Sixers had any situations that might shed some light on what the Hawks are going to face and what we might expect from Lloyd Pierce in those kind of contexts?
Yeah, so with this past season, honestly, very rare would you end up with those situations. J.J. Redick, even though he's not big, is deceptively strong. He's very, like, toned.
Sure.
So he, like, wouldn't necessarily just get run over by people, with some exceptions. Like, if Jaylen Brown was taking him down the post, Jaylen Brown's 240 pounds worth of muscle. So, like, he wouldn't stand a chance there. But in most cases, he could fight. Same with T.J. McConnell, who's our other smallest player on the court. But in prior years, he had people like Ish Smith on the roster. And Ish has been around. He may have been a Hawk at one point. He's been on, like, 12 teams.
I don't know the answer to that question. It's amazing. I really don't know. I might have to look that up.
Yeah, he may have been. I don't know. So Ish Smith is about 6'1", 6'2", and really thin.
Sure.
And so when the Sixers had him, they would try to keep him off of many lead ball handlers because he just was so small, he would not be able to fight through screens. And this was still while Lloyd Pierce was running the defense. He's run the defense since, I believe, not anymore, but I think even starting with the 10-win season, the infamous 10-win season, I think was his first go-around where Ish was on the team. And what they did,
get a lot of those 10 wins.
He was really responsible for like 8 of them.
Didn't it feel like that? Yeah, okay. I'm not imagining it. Okay, good.
You're not. That was the less we talk about that time, the better. But but in cases like that where they had weak defenders at the point of attack, they would try to hide them. Likewise, they tried hiding Redick where they could. They would hide him on the person that would do the theoretical least damage, which is what made Boston such a bad matchup, because everyone on that roster could do damage against J.J. Redick just because they're so big and strong.
Right.
But the issue with defenders like that is no matter how much you scheme around them, there's always going to be that issue where you are smaller than the opponent in most cases. So while he can scheme it and move Trae Young off the ball, especially if they have another defender who can defend at the point of attack on the court, whether it's Jeremy Lin, whether they move Taurean Prince up, and I love Taurean Prince.
Yeah, it's something that Bazemore does well.
Bazemore, I forgot he's there.
Very Covington-like in that regard.
I forgot Bazemore was still a Hawk.
Wait, you can't forget. He's the best Hawk. So you had to factor him in and pick a new second best Hawk.
That's true. Right,
we'll get to that in a minute. Sorry, I'm taking you down too many detours.
But anyway.
Okay. Well, then let's do that. Let's bad segues, but let's get into that list of what we're going to do is we're going to rank the second best players on each team in the Eastern Conference.
And this involves also figuring out who the second best player is and whether we agree on it too.
Oh, sure. I mean, we're going to have different rankings. We're going to have different players. We're going to be all over the place. But I propose that we kind of work it bottom up.
Yeah, that's probably the way to go.
Okay. So why don't you lead us in with your number 15?
Okay, so this is a weird one. So I couldn't – this. It's going to be the Cavs here.
Okay.
And their second best players are all like – it's just a – I don't even know.
You're picking some flawed diamonds.
Yeah, it's like do you really want to put J.R. Smith in that spot? I didn't. I wanted to put Kyle Korver there, but he's 37 at this point. Love Kyle Korver, former Hawk and former Sixer 10 years ago, but former Sixer. But he won't play enough. I put Tristan Thompson there. I don't feel good about it, but he has a track record of being a good defensive center and rebounder. Last year may have been an aberration based on a lot of personal stuff going on as well as injuries. He will probably want to get out of Cleveland, so he has incentive to play well. So I went with him in the 15th spot and don't feel good about it at all.
Okay. I didn't really, when I proposed this exercise to you, I didn't really lay out a whole lot of guidelines. But I have to say that in my own mind, the way I went about it was, if we take whatever team that's in question and start a playoff series tomorrow, mm-hmm. who's the second most important player in that playoff series against some generic NBA opponent?
Mm. Gotcha.
And so that's kind of how I laid it out. And so, yeah, in somehow that context, I didn't pick Tristan Thompson, but we'll get to mine in a minute. I didn't have Cleveland as my 15. I had Charlotte. And it seems like, you know, somewhere Nick Batum might be really important. I mean, it was hard to pick some of these number twos just because, you know, two, three, four, sometimes one, they were all really close. And honestly, I ended up with Marvin Williams when I picked it. And so then when I did the rankings, he just seemed like the 15th best player out of the rankings.
Oh, gosh.
Maybe I don't have Batum if he's healthy.
I picked Cody Zeller.
Yeah, that was my other. That was it. It was going to be Cody Zeller, Marvin Williams, or Batum. I don't have enough faith in – I mean, I honestly even considered, like, players that just got drafted if I thought that they would honestly be the second best player. In fact, I have two of them in my list, and I just don't have any faith in the relatively young Hornets. Mm-hmm. And Cody Zeller, I honestly, maybe if Dwight Howard isn't there, and I look at what kind of season Zeller was coming off, if he had been the starter, I probably would have picked him. But I ended up picking Marvin Williams, and all I can really just do there is just shrug.
Yeah, that's a bad team.
And one more thing about Charlotte, like, Dwight was kind of good last season. I don't know. Kind of good. Like, I mean, considering what was there on that roster, like, they might have even been better if Zeller had started and they didn't have mm-hmm. Dwight at all. But it's not like he ruined some magnificent team. There's just not a lot there aside from Kemba Walker. So,
and he's only going to be there for one more year. So wow. What are they going to do?
That's not good. All right. Give me your number 14.
Okay. So this is going to be a maybe controversial one. I don't know. So this is actually the Bulls.
Okay.
Who I really am just not a fan of.
I'm getting to them very soon.
Okay, good. And it's even worse, the player I put there. So I have Robin Lopez as their second best player. If I look at their roster.
I mean, he's in my list. He does NBA things.
He does NBA things, which... And he's like a net positive contributor, which is to say I trust maybe four Bulls to do.
Wow, that's a lot. That's more than I would have.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of them's a rookie. Lowry, Markkanen, I love. Basically, everyone else in that roster I could do away with. Robin Lopez is probably the best of the rest.
I think that's fair. I'm going to say a lot of the same things. My number 14 was Damari Carroll. I'm laughing just saying. Like, it should be Jarrett Allen. But again, like, okay, so awesome. Spencer Dinwiddie is their number one. A clear number one for them. Really nice NBA player. Good for Spencer Dinwiddie. And, like, Jarrett Allen's good. But, like, not do stuff in a playoff series good. Like, there are going to be situations in a playoff series where he just gets played off the floor. He's got great defensive potential and a lot of offensive potential too. I'm just not sure that if if it was an actual playoff series in this very moment, that he would be as impactful as Damari Carroll, as sad as that is to say. And I don't even want to get into the rest of the roster. They haven't had any draft picks in a long, long time. So Brooklyn's not very good. Who's your number 13? The Eastern Conference is...
Wow.
This whole exercise, like, I want to do this again for the West at some point, and it's going to be so unbelievably, completely, totally different. Like, if you put these lists side by side, it's just going to be astounding. Like, the West list versus the East list. It's just going to be stupefying. Anyways, let me hear your number 13.
This is actually Cody Zeller. So we've already discussed okay. that. So where are you falling in here?
I echo what you say about the Bulls. Markkanen's my clear-cut number one. And, like, Lopez is one of the few guys that I trust to do NBA-competent things on both sides of the floor. I'm frightened to see what Jabari and LaVine look like together. Just,
oh, same.
It's going to be such an awful defense. And so I put Wendell Carter, like, sort of for the same reasons you picked Lopez. I just think that Carter might be a little bit more impactful as an offensive rebounder and as a shot, you know, as a shot blocker. If the playoff series started today and they got in trouble defensively, I don't know. I think that he'd matter a lot. As crazy as that sounds, it doesn't seem like something that should be going to a rookie, but anyways, that's where I ended up.
Honestly, perfectly fair, because yeah, I had Carter and Dunn right behind Lopez, and I was just like, that's another one I did not feel good about.
All right. How about number 12?
Okay, so this is where the Hawks come in.
Okay. I was surprised. I didn't want to be the homer, and then I started putting this list together, and just in terms of their number two player, I've got them pretty high, and I feel like a bad homer, but it's perfectly fair to have them at number 12. But who is it?
Don't worry, because you can guess who I have at number one. Anyway, number 12, I actually put Jeremy Lin.
Okay.
So I really like Jeremy Lin. Despite him being injured almost all the time, when given the keys to an offense, and I think he won't have the main keys. Trae Young should, by all accounts, get as many opportunities to do whatever he can from 30 feet away from the rim. I will watch it. It will be fun. But I think in terms of just someone who can create offense for himself and others, someone who can defend reasonably, not great,
right.
Certainly not, but he can hold his own enough on defense. He tries very hard. And who really, his last season in Charlotte, he was really, really good for them. So I'm a Jeremy Lin believer. I have him as number two. For you guys, I actually put Bazemore three.
That's fair.
And I love myself some Torian Prince. So I have Prince as one, Lin two, and Bazemore three. I'm perfectly ready to get blasted for that, but I just like Jeremy Lin a lot. I actually think the Hawks have more talent than they're giving credit for.
All right. I went with Orlando at 12. Not a huge fan of the roster. Sort of my meh number one was Aaron Gordon. And that left me with Evan Fournier as a two. And he seems like their second best player. You know, again, sort of in the playoff series context, I think he does enough on both ends. You know, not that much on defense, but enough that he'd be somebody that would be out there, you know, probably play the second most minutes. That whole Orlando roster just feels so big, heavy, playmaker, light. And,
yep.
You know, I think he'd be critical for them if they were in a playoff series. Don't laugh. You know, if the Magic were in a playoff series.
I actually have Fournier as mine as well, but weirdly much further up the list, but I think that's more personal preference. We'll get to that later, though.
Okay. All right, you're 11.
This is the Nets spot. And again, since we put the list together under a little different guises, I see where you're coming from with Damari Carroll, especially given how important wing defenders are. And he was better last year than he was with the Raptors.
Yeah.
So I'll give him that. That said, I did go with Jared Allen here.
That's good.
All right, what do you have?
I had the Cleveland. I went with J.R. Smith. I think that honestly their second best player is Korver in terms of like when are they going to be best on the floor. Like the on-off splits are going to be better with Korver than they would be with Smith. I think Korver's just a better player, but he's 37. He's not going to play that many minutes. So I punted and went with J.R. Smith, which I think is a terrible choice because I think there's going to be a steep drop-off for him without LeBron. But in a vacuum today, before we see that drop-off, I'm going to put him there. All right, who's your 10? I feel like there's a team that has to show up here, but maybe I'm wrong.
It's the Knicks, right?
Yeah, I mean, it should be the Knicks. I was really optimistic when I did the Knicks. You're right, it should be the Knicks. It should be.
So I haven't shown up with the Magic yet. They're still coming. But I have Courtney Lee as my second best Knick player. Obviously, Porzingis being number one. Courtney Lee is just, he's been around forever. Everyone knows what he does. He's a good shooter. He can defend point guards and shooting guards. And he generally makes the right play at the right time. He is on the entirely wrong team and needs to get out of there as soon as possible.
Okay. My 10 was Detroit and Andre Drummond.
Oh, wow. Where would I have him?
Like that roster, I don't know. I had Blake as my number one, and then a whole lot of shrugging for number two. And, you know, I think Drummond had a good year. He got, you know, made big strides as a free throw shooter, you know, a really great rebounder, and, you know, seems like an adequate defender. And so in a playoff series, you know, I think there'd be some matchups that might be problematic just because of what he brings on offense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, with a lot of shrugs, I've got him as my second best Piston. And I don't even it was basically him or Reggie Jackson and then a big drop off. So,
yeah, that roster is a morass behind Reggie Jackson. I'm not even a Reggie Jackson guy.
No,
he's the only capable ball handler aside from Mitch Smith there.
Reggie Jackson's like Dennis Schroeder who can't stay healthy.
That's a good comp. He's a slower Schroeder somehow. And yet just as I'm gonna leave it at that. I have Drummond much higher though. And have him as a second, although I actually really debated one versus two because Blake Griffin had a terrible year last year.
Right.
By his standards. So but I'll get to that when I start talking about where I rank Drummond.
Okay. Your turn. We're at 9, I think, right?
Yep. So this is where the entire Miami Heat roster is ranked. So I had a really hard time with the Heat. And I don't know if you did as well, but the Heat have
I was like, I got my guy.
So I really struggled with like 1 through 7.
Wow, that's good that they're that deep.
So I don't think very highly of the Heat. I think that they are a try-hard team that outperformed what their expectation would have been last year and is at best in a real league that's not the Eastern Conference, a 10 or 11 seed. They don't have that much top-end talent.
Right.
They're mostly older.
Right.
I'm not really sure what they're doing. That said, I eventually settled 1-2 between Goran Dragic, who ended up at number one, and Josh Richardson, who I put at number two. Richardson kind of disappeared during the first-round playoff series last year against the Sixers.
Yep.
Mostly because he had no one he could reasonably defend. His best role is as like a wing defender stopper, and the Sixers just play differently than everybody. It kind of made Richardson useless, and he wasn't hitting that many shots. But I watched enough Heat last year during the regular season to think that he may have been their most important player. because of his defensive versatility, because he was able to do a little bit of everything on offense, to a degree even more so than Dragic. But Dragic was just responsible for so much more of their offense. I had to rank him first.
Sounds good. I had the Hawks at 9. I guess if I were going to put my players 1 through 5, I would put Bazemore, Collins, Lynn as my 3rd, and then Prince and Trae Young. And so I guess, you know, I'm really high on John Collins. So as a result, yeah. I think he could play now. Like, I don't think there are a lot of flaws in his game right now. So if there were a playoff series, and again, the Hawks aren't going to touch a playoff series for a while, but if the Hawks were in a playoff series that started tomorrow, he'd probably, you know, figure prominently. So I had the Hawks very high. All right, so theoretically now we're at 8. So in terms of the second best players, these are, I guess, playoff caliber second best players. Or maybe not.
I'm not sure about that. This is where I have Fournier. Answer is probably not.
I mean, he's a good player. He's an offensive almost dynamo. I mean, he does a lot of things, so.
Yeah, I like to think of him like, if you were on a better team, he would be the Bojan Bogdanovic of another team, where he surprises you with how much defense he ends up playing on LeBron James and give you enough offense to kind of make it work for a series. I would like him in a better scenario. I don't like how much responsibility he has right now in Orlando because of how terribly that roster is built.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting into Bojan territory. So that seems like a perfectly reasonable argument. I actually had the Knicks here. I didn't know what to do with the Knicks. Kristaps as the clear-cut 1. You had Lee as your number 2. I had him as my number 3. I had Tilakina, Hardaway, and Cantor as sort of also-rans. But my number 2 is Kevin Knox. I don't know. I mean, you look at that Knicks roster, and I'm probably being really overly optimistic. Maybe I should have put Collins there. I felt if I had the Hawks in the top 8, I would have felt too much like a homer. So I'm just going to be bright and optimistic about Kevin Knox, and maybe Knicks fans have something hopeful to cheer for, because I think he's going to be a good player. I just think his athleticism, combined with his shooting, he's going to get there as an NBA player. And yeah, it's not going to take long, I don't think.
He looked good when he played over the summer.
All right, 7.
Well, now I think we got into legitimate player territory. Okay. At least in my list. I have Chris Middleton at number 7.
Oh, see, this is the first one where I disagree a lot. That seems really low.
Yeah, I think so. The impetus for this is I think I had a pretty clear top 4.
Okay.
And I think that the top 4 is, I think we're going to be very close on that.
Okay.
But I have this next here. Andre Drummond's in here.
Okay.
And another player who I'll reveal shortly. And then Middleton. And for I watched a lot of the Bucks Celtics series last year. And the one thing that got me about Middleton is he's just not quite as athletic as he once was, or his defense isn't as sharp as it once was. But it seemed like he was more of an offensive wing than I remembered, where he was more exploitable on defense last year. And I do worry that, especially since they asked for Giannis to do everything in Milwaukee, that Middleton is really a one-way player on the wing, where really you, not even a one-way, maybe a one and a half way on the wing. And you really need a two-way wing to make a bigger impact. And I have all these, I really like the top 7 in this look. I think the top 7 is an appropriate top 7. You and I disagree on Drummond, but we'll get there.
And I just preferred the bigs in my list to Middleton here. That said, I know you have ties to Milwaukee, so I'm sure that you think differently. But that was my thought process on Middleton.
Okay.
I think not quite an all-star. I think his defense, while not necessarily lacking, can be exploited. And I prefer some of the other guys on this list.
It's funny you mentioned all-star because I'm looking at my list and it's like, I have Middleton higher than you. But if I look at my list and say, which one of these players should be all-stars, I think I've got, I want to say two. Maybe I'm being harsh. Maybe it should be more than that. But there are two like rock solid all-stars, and then just the rest is just like, oh, they seem like they're on the fringe. For my number seven, I had Bojan Bogdanović. I know we mentioned earlier, I mentioned that Wizards Hawks playoff series from 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Dwight Howard and Ersan Ilyasova and so on. And like, it's amazing that it felt like the Hawks played him off the floor as a defender at times in that series. Like, he couldn't stay on the floor with just a team that really wasn't anything special.
Yeah.
And then last year, he was so good in the regular season. And then in the playoffs, he was spectacular. I don't know if we're talking about injuries or confidence or what, but I've got him as my second best pacer. Sort of like with Brooklyn, like it feels like it should be Turner in the way that the Nets have felt like it should be Jarrett Allen.
Mm-hmm.
But just in terms of the actual production and what you'd get out of them in a playoff series and who a coach might lean on, I think I have to go with Bojan and over Turner. So, and that's with obviously Oladipo being the strong number one.
Yeah, that's fair. I actually have Turner in my next spot. Okay. And I can elaborate on that as well.
Your turn, so go for it.
Yeah. So Miles Turner had a down year last year.
Yeah.
Despite the Pacers' overall success, he wasn't actually that pivotal to that success. If I were basing it on players that I wanted last season based off their production, I actually would have put Darren Collison here.
Yep, he had a great season.
He led the league in three-point percentage. He did a lot for them and basically had a career year at age 30. But he's a six-foot-tall point guard at going to be 31. I just don't see that keeping up. Miles Turner's only going to be 22, but he truly did extend his range out to the three-point line. He's more mobile than most centers. It comes with some drawbacks because he can get pushed around, but he should be, based off of everything I've seen out of him, he should be an elite defender this year. I really like his game. So I went with him number six with the idea being I think he'll take a step this year and be someone they can rely upon more. I'm actually really high on the Pacers as a team in general.
Sure. I had a long list for the Pacers. It was like, you know, Turner, Tyreke Evans, Thaddeus Young, Collison. You know, that was a lot deeper of a list than I had for most teams.
Yeah. They have a lot of really solid guys behind Oladipo.
Yeah.
And that was the story on them going in the last year. It was like they have a bunch of solid guys, but who do they have that could actually make a difference? And then Oladipo came out of nowhere to be a borderline top 10 NBA player. That's how they're so good. And yeah, I just really like that team a lot. And I really like what Miles Turner's skills and abilities are. And I think that he'll be able to capitalize on them.
I had Miami as my number six. I went with Josh Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is kind of like you. I just felt like no matter the context or the situation, Goran Dragic just kind of puts his stamp on a game. I mean, you always kind of remember he's out there. They're always playing a certain way. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's just going to have the ball in his hands for pick and rolls and make good decisions. And so as much as I like Josh Richardson as a defender, I just couldn't quite push him into that number one spot for Miami. So I had him as my number two. And I think he's more impactful than, you know, somebody like Kelly Olynyk, who, you know, has played in some pretty big playoff games and done reasonably well, but I just think there are situations in games where, you know, he's not going to be as impactful as somebody like Josh Richardson. Who'd you have as number five? I think now we're getting interesting.
So this is where Drummond falls in for me.
Wow, that's right. You didn't have Detroit yet. Okay, yeah, I guess I should have seen that one coming then.
Yeah. I think it's basically, I don't expect Blake Griffin to have as bad of a year as he did last year. So that's why Drummond is basically a de facto number two for them. I do think, though, that he took some really legitimate steps forward last year.
Sure.
He got into some beefs with Joel Embiid, but then made up with him afterward because he's a good player on, like, Hassan Whiteside.
sorry. That's perfectly fair.
He really became a big part of, like, their set offense. He was really involved in their passing game. And then, obviously, everyone knows his free throw percentage jumped from abominable to still bad, but functional enough.
Yep.
That's where I don't think he gets played off the court anymore. His defense also seemingly improved.
Yep.
He's always been active on the perimeter as a defender, which makes me think that he wouldn't get played off the court more often. He's always among the league leaders in steals, which is something as a center is almost otherwise unheard of. And he just rebounds like nobody else in the league, 16 per game last year, I think. So I had him at number five. I do think that if he could take another inch forward with his free throw percentage, it'll be really, really good.
It's astounding how young he is.
Yeah.
It feels like he's been around forever.
And he looks so old.
maybe that's part of it. He just barely turned 25.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a young player when he was drafted, but he always has looked a little older than his age. But you have to remember that he's made big steps each of the last two summers, I think. So, I think he's really good. Even though I do agree that there are situations where he could get played off the court because of his free throw shooting. Otherwise, I think he's a really useful piece for the Pistons, aside from with the rest of their roster being a complete cluster.
So I'm at number five. Maybe you're expecting Chris Middleton, but no, I have him. I have him higher than that. I went with Kyle Lowry here.
That's fair.
The thinking being that Kawhi is healthy and a clear cut number one if he is. And you know, Toronto, like if you had to rank their players 5 through 10. They'd be really deep, but I really didn't think there were a whole lot of other contenders for the second best Raptor.
No. I agree with you and have Lowry in the next spot.
Okay. That's easy. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, really, I think you go 1, 2, and then 3 is probably Anunoby at this point.
Okay, wow.
As the second wing defender. Mm-hmm. Just because they always struggle, it seems like, with having enough shooting and defense on the court. I just think he's pivotally important for them. But after that, it's just like they have such a deep roster that that's what makes them so good.
So I had John Wall next.
Oh,
wait, really?
Yeah, John Wall being second.
I'm on number four. Yeah, so I had John Wall as my number four. Yeah, again, I had Chris Middleton kind of high. I don't know. I like John Wall. I like him as, you know, a personality, and I like him as a player. But he's not that good a shooter. His defense is kind of hit or miss. I mean, it's not what it was when he like came into the league or anything like that. He kind of bristles with some teammates. I think the Wizards are going to be absolutely awful this year. Like if it's a reasonable hypothesis to say that, you know, Gortat was traded because he didn't get along with Wall, then that's not good because they're going to be kind of a wreck this season, I think, with Dwight Howard.
Yeah, they have really high implosion potential. It's actually probably one of the more interesting Eastern Conference stories. I didn't have them as my number two, though. I had them as the number one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the reason why is because I think, honestly, he's been misused for most of his career. He should be playing on a team that has a top five pace every year. They should be spacing the court around, and they should have a rim-running center. They should not be playing through the post. They should not be doing whatever weird stuff Scott Brooks has them doing. If they just had a team that functioned like a real team around him, he would be, I think, seen as one of the best players in the NBA and more engaged.
Yeah, I mean, you like, just so contextually, like, John Wall hasn't been dealt the best hand. Like, he had to go to a team in the Wizards that was just kind of perpetually blah. They put him on a team with Nick Young, Andre Blatch, and JaVale McGee as a rookie. His two coaches have been Scott Brooks and Randy Whitman.
Ugh.
I mean, I really like John Wall, but in the year 2018, having had, you know, multiple years of dealing with all that baggage, I'm just not that sure that he's that good. Like, I think it's Bradley Beal's time. So, yeah, I had him as a number two. I've lost track, so we're supposed to do your number three team now?
Yeah, and I have Beal here.
Okay. Oh, you have Beal. Okay.
Yeah, I have Beal as the number two for the Wizards. He did have a really good year last year. Not going to take that away from him. I just, like I said, I'm a big John Wall fan and do think he's been misused and do think that them constantly thinking that they need a center who can, like, post up as a concept, it's just so backwards. And given any game, John Wall can just take over and be one of the more dominant players in the NBA. I know it's like a cliche riddled statement. But when John Wall's going, he's one of the best players in the league, in my opinion. It just hasn't happened often enough. Whereas Brad Beal is more of a consistent, good player. I do think his shot selection can be erratic. But him becoming more of a, really just a really good ball handler, shooter off the dribble that he's become over the last 2 years. Despite my love of Otto Porter and his game overall, I had him as a clear number two for the Wizards and number three overall. I didn't really, basically 3-1, I was pretty set in the order that I had them.
Yeah. I'm a sucker for shooting guards. Like, I feel like if you have a real top tier shooting guard, and there aren't that many of them, that you're almost a good team by default. Like, I mean, how many are, I don't know. And this, yeah, I mean, I'm a big Klay Thompson person. I'm dying to see what a team looks like with Klay Thompson and less talent. I think that they would still be pretty good. I don't know. So, yeah, I guess I'm a big sucker for the shooting guards. And Bradley Beal, like, Bradley Beal is one of those people that I'm excited just to see warm up. Like, if Steph Curry is the most exciting player in the league to just watch warm up, I'd probably have Beal in my top five. It's just beautiful. Like, the form, the athleticism. He's one of those people who's, like, just seems bigger in person. He just has a lot of presence out there. It's just gorgeous. I just love watching him shoot. But my number three is Chris Middleton.
We got there.
I had him up there really high. I guess we both got Boston and Philly at the top. So that's going to be interesting, the players and the order. But I love me some Chris Middleton. I know you mentioned his defense. I would put half of that, at least half of that defensive liability just on the scheme.
That's fair.
They were not well coached defensively, I don't think, last season. I'm really interested to see what he looks like with Mike Budenholzer at the helm. But let's get to Boston and Philly. Did you homer out here? Who's your second best player? Who's your second best of the second best players?
Okay, so I did homer out. so I went with this is actually the hardest one, Boston, because
I really didn't know what order to put one and two in. I ended up settling on Al Horford being the number two. Okay. Even though I love his game.
Wait, I think who's the number one in that context?
Kyrie Irving.
Okay.
I think he may be functionally more important to what Boston does than Kyrie Irving. Because of he's basically good at everything. And seemingly never gets worse at anything, only somehow like improves his game even as he gets older. And basically fills all the holes that Boston has in their lineup. That said, they really do need Kyrie Irving's offense to kind of prop up the rest of the team.
Right.
The Sixers really collapsed, honestly, in the second round against them. They should have won more than one game. The Celtics survived based off the defense that they have, but they just didn't have enough offense to make it to the NBA Finals. And I don't think they would ever have enough unless they had someone like Kyrie Irving to helm their offense. So it's kind of what I settled on. I went Irving 1, Horford 2, and really went with the homer pick at number 1.
I had Ben Simmons as my second best player.
Yep.
I mean, he's so good. Like, I mean, there are flaws in his game, but if you just watch his highlight reel, it's like, well, how is anybody ever going to stop that? Like, that seems pretty unstoppable. That should be something that nobody can defend ever. And I don't know if it's like the Sixers just need to put more shooting around him or what, but there's times where he just looks like, you know, he should be the best player in the league in five seasons, if not three. And, you know, Joel Embiid is more of a focal point and, you know, does more on both ends. But it's kind of close. I mean, it's not like it's Embiid is light years ahead of Simmons. I mean, that 1-2 choice there was really, really close for me. So who did you pick from the Sixers?
So I went with Simmons as well.
Okay. And you can elaborate on much better than I can. Why?
That wasn't a bad synopsis, actually. So it would have been much less close had the last 15 or so games of the Sixers season not happened.
Okay.
If you remember, Joel Embiid got hurt. He played the playoffs with the mask on due to like basically a broken face. And the Sixers won their last 16 games of the year, mostly without Embiid. And the reason for that was because the Sixers pretty much changed the way they played. They played a lot more five out. They played a lot more Simmons-centric offense. They sped up the pace, and they shot a lot more three-pointers. Unlike the rest of the season where they kind of catered to Joel Embiid's style, they catered to Ben Simmons' style, and they were still dominant. Although in this variation of the Sixers, they were much more dominant on the offensive side of the court than on the defensive side. Now, part of that you can attribute to playing bad teams for 15 games.
That was true.
The Sixers played, no mean to hate, but the Sixers played the Hawks twice, I believe. Yeah,
I remember those games.
But it was a much different team than what you had seen earlier in the year. And it kind of showed that if you build a team around Ben Simmons, you know, it's going to do pretty well. And I think we had different aims with this list. I tried as best as I could to say, okay, which of these players is the second best player on their team? And then which of them are the best without taking into consideration like time, circumstance, or even to a degree like teammates.
Okay.
And I think independently of anything, Simmons is probably, at least in my mind, a top 15 NBA player right now. And has the potential, if his jumper made any progress over the summer, which I honestly doubt a little bit, but if he's willing to shoot it and hits enough of them, the change that it will make to his game, to me, would turn him into the unstoppable player that you're describing. Again, the series against Boston kind of looms over everything that the Sixers do and how poorly they performed. That said, it wasn't necessarily even something that I would attribute to the Celtics. I would attribute to inexperience and even to a degree immaturity on the Sixers' part. Because the coaches obviously had the team prepared. They ran the right sets. They made the right calls from a personnel perspective, aside from a couple of cases, in my opinion. The Sixers just were not ready to execute them. And I think with experience, they will be. And I think Simmons, like you mentioned, he has top one potential. That said, so does Embiid. And Embiid's a top 10 player right now, in my opinion. Wow. Yeah, I mean, he's a top two defensive player. And his on-court, off-courts are just so dominant that's basically the way I have to conclude, I think. So that's why I went with Simmons at number one, because I do think that he's a great player right now, and he'll have a chance to be even greater. He's only going to be 22 this year.
I went with Boston, obviously, and my logic for picking Al Horford was really similar to yours in the Kyrie comparison. I think they're actually, in a way, an ideal pairing. Just, you know,
they are
what they do for each other. Kyrie offensively and Horford defensively, they're really just, you know, essentially offensive and defensive dynamos. I mean, Horford is just such a freaking good defender. I mean, he's not that big. But, you know, his mobility, you know, what he does on the perimeter for a big guy and what he does and just kind of organizing the defense and filling all the gaps all the time with just ridiculous consistency, you know, he's just a great player. Offensively, you know, his ability to shoot the three is just uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the one news story that I've ever done in my life that actually amounted to anything in terms of news was just the season where he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to shoot more three-pointers this season. It's like, oh, well, that's a big development. And it ended up happening. And it just makes him such a great player. He's a good passer. You know, he can do things in the post. The one, you know, maybe the one knock on him is that, you know, when he sets up with that three-point shot, if it's not a three-point shot, he's going to his right. Everybody in the league should know that by now. Mm-hmm. And it's like Monte Ellis. Like, if he doesn't go right, he's going to go further and harder to the right. Horford's the same way. And so teams should load up, I would think, but they don't. And as a result, he's just a magnificent player. Simmons has a higher ceiling. But I was very, what is it right now? And I think right now, just Horford's so polished, so. I had him as my best of the second best players in the second best conference.
Yeah, and just to finish up on Horford, everything he does just makes everyone else around him so much better.
Yeah.
Whether it's the shooting he provides, he sets the best screens in the NBA at this point. they're all illegal. I don't know how he gets away with it.
Oh, but that's how I feel about Gortat and Zeller, and honestly, you know, that would have been a big reason for me putting Zeller in the list if I had. Like, that just adds so much to an offense when you can get away with it.
Yeah. And he's always in the perfect spot on the pick and roll where if there's an open, like if he gets the person hooked on the screen, he's always ready to roll. If they get around him, he's ready to pop. He's just so good. I'm kind of regretting putting him at number two now, but I can't not be a homer.
It's okay. Be a homer.
Okay.
All right, Sean, plug anything you want to plug. I didn't even name your site at the beginning because I'm a slack host. So take this opportunity and do it justice because I didn't.
Well, I'm mostly inactive, but still a member of the Liberty Ballers community, the Sixers FB Nation site. You can follow me on Twitter, SOConnor76. O'Connor is spelled with an O. And I'll be writing sporadically this year with multiple career things getting in the way. But really excited to write about a good team for hopefully the second year in a row.
All right. Well, thank you for indulging me today. There's a lot of Hawks 76ers intersectionality, for lack of a better word, but just a lot of common threads in it. It seemed like a good time to do this sort of thing. So
yeah,
I appreciate you helping me fill in the dead times of August and September.
Not a problem. Be happy to come on again in August or September.
Thanks, Sean. Have a good night.
All right. Thank you.